So rebellion is at the heart of humanity. There is not a single person in human history who needs to learn how to reject and to rebel against authority, right? I mean, it's kind of innate even in an infant. Martin Luther's idea that we speak about often here at Branchton, the Latin phrase in curvature say, that we are curved in on ourselves, explains why we are like this. You and I have a nature that rejects and fights against God as our creator and as our king. We have a natural bent inward towards ourselves and away from God and away from others. Now, relationally, this shows up in two extremes. On the one hand, our curved in nature causes some of us to speak truth to people without compassion. And you may say, I'm one of those people. When you say something or when somebody does something that doesn't align with what you want, you quickly and you forcefully call them out. That's one extreme. But on the other end, there's somebody where you speak compassion and you show compassion to people, but you withhold truth from them. You withhold the truth. When someone says or does something that doesn't align with your desires or what you believe to be true, what you do is you sweep it under the rug. You don't say a word to them. And the other person actually has no idea that they've hurt you or they've done something to offend you. Jesus says that both of these approaches fails to truly love a person. It actually shows that you love yourself more than you love the other. Jesus had this uncanny ability to perfectly speak truth and show compassion at the same time. And I think that's why Luke calls him the great physician, right? The best doctors know that sometimes you have to hurt in order to heal. To heal a wound, sometimes you have to cauterize it. Showing compassion without speaking the truth to somebody isn't love. Yet speaking truth without showing compassion isn't love either. You see, you and I are both rebel-hearted. And the ending of a life that rebels against God is devastation and ruin. Jesus gives to us exactly what we need to change these rebel hearts. And what we need is truth plus compassion. And I pray that the people of Jesus that's here at Branchton today and the people of Jesus abroad and his church throughout the world can learn how to show both truth and compassion to people like Jesus does in our text, both to the scribes and Pharisees and to the adulterous woman. Let's go ahead and begin with our proposition. So we're going to see the big idea is this, and we're trying to distinguish right now why Jesus is so beautiful to Christians in this early part of our series. Christians love Jesus because he restores life, and he restores life by confrontation. But this confrontation is into our rebellion, and he confronts our rebellion, yes, with truth, but also with such sweet compassion. So we're going to look at two kinds of people today that is exemplified through the Pharisees, yes, and through this adulterous woman. And what I want you to see is actually what is going on at the roots of both kinds of people, uber-religious people who find God useful but not beautiful, and then people who want to live life, have sexuality and relationships their way instead of God's way. They actually have the same problem. They're both rebel-hearted. Both are equally lost. It's just that one, the scribes and the Pharisees, they don't look like on the outside that they're lost because they serve. They show up at synagogue. They tithe, right? They even give off their dill and their mint, right? But both are in equal need of Jesus to restore life to them through confrontation and confronting their rebel hearts. And then ironically, or I think beautifully, this is why Christians actually love Jesus. We love that he restores us by confronting our rebellion and seeing us and calling us out for who we are and yet still loving us. So I believe that the opposite of love actually isn't hate. I think love and hate have an awesome relationship with each other when you understand hate correctly. The opposite of love is not hate. It's actually indifference. And I think this is why both extremes miss the mark. The person who speaks truth with no compassion for the other, and then the other person who will just show compassion but never speak the truth, why both of those extremes miss the mark. Because of our curved-in nature, it is easy for some people, and you may say, what? How is this easy? But it's easy for some people to speak the truth and not show compassion. And for other people, it's safer for them just to show compassion and not speak the truth to the person. But for the Christian who is experiencing both things simultaneously from Jesus in real time, day in and day out, a change begins to take place in us over time. So whether you start Christianity over here on truth with no compassion, or you start over here with compassion but little to no truth, a change takes place in both kinds of people. If you tend to speak truth without compassion, you begin to see people the way that Jesus sees people. And we saw how Jesus sees people last week in Matthew 9. He goes from city to city, village to village, preaching and teaching, and he sees people that they are distressed and they are dispirited, like they are sheep without a shepherd. Over time, you, the Christian, begin to see people that way. And if you tend to show compassion to people without speaking the truth to them, Jesus begins this work in you to speak to people in a way that actually honors him as the way, the truth, and the life, definitive, the one and only. Jesus does this work in us over time through our own experience of his truth and his compassion in our rebel hearts as he confronts the rebellion that's deep down inside of us, as he straightens out our spiritual scoliosis. And this is what I hope that the Holy Spirit will confront you with today through John chapter 8. So let's begin. Let's unpack some portions of this. Let's look at our first point. What I want you to see is that, I mean, because Jesus is light, he exposes, right? Light exposes darkness. So Jesus exposes the depths of rebellion. But he does this by extending both truth and compassion. And we're going to see he doesn't just do this for the liberal or the adulterous woman. He also does this to the conservative Pharisee as well, which gives us hope, because if you are here today, whether you like it or not, you're actually more on the conservative side because you're doing something that's in the minority in this country right now. So let's walk through John 8. Jesus is in Jerusalem's temple, the center of Jewish religion in the first century. He is in one of the temple courts in the temple complex. There are several courts in Jerusalem's temple at this time. There's a court of priests. He's not there because only the aristocratic priests could go there. There's the court of Israel where the Jewish men gathered. Well, they brought a woman there, so most likely he's not in that court. There's the court of women where if you were a Jewish woman, you could only go so far into the temple or else it was scandalous for you. Like what we're doing right now, sitting boy, girl, girl, boy, right, is scandalous for a first century Jew. Maybe Jesus was there. And then there's at the very outskirts of the temple complex was the court of the Gentiles, where if you didn't have Abraham's blood flowing through you and you wanted to worship God, that's where you were, so far away and disconnected from all the action that was going on in the center of the temple court. So Jesus is teaching, maybe in the court of women, maybe in the court of the Gentiles, we don't fully know. And the scribes and the Pharisees approach him. Now the scribes and the Pharisees represent the very heart of conservatism for the Jewish faith in the first century. The scribes were experts in Tanakh. Their job was to, okay, we have a manuscript of the Tanakh, our Old Testament. My job is to bind and then create and write a copy of it. And I'm copying. And this is where, if you ever hear, for the most part, 95% of the errors in the Bible that liberals or critics like to say are in the Bible are actually from because these Jewish scribes, back in the day, before Gutenberg and the printing press in the 1500s, they copied Tanakh by hand. And we call them the error of the eye, from the transmission of copying from one book to another. And I could show you on a Wednesday night, there's so many Hebrew letters that look similar, and Greek. Smudge happens over time, right? We call this errors of the eye. But what happened to the scribes over time is that because they were copying scripture for different synagogues, right, they became proficient in the scriptures. They memorized the scriptures. And so they could be counted on in Jewish culture. What does Yahweh say about X? A scribe would say, I know, because I've copied it 10,000 times. Now, the Pharisees were the strict conservative movement in Judaism during this time. And they focused on total and absolute obedience to Mosaic law. They knew Mosaic law so well and applied it so strictly to their lives, they also expected others to do it as well. So they knew that, okay, on Saturday, on Sabbath day, there's no work, so let me help you define what does it look like to be a good Jew and not do any work on the Sabbath. How many steps could you take? What could you lift and not lift? These were the guys that clarified it for the culture. So the scribes and the Pharisees bring a woman to Jesus and interrupt Jesus' teaching in the temple court. This woman has been caught, John says, in the very act of having sex with a man who is not her husband. Scribes and Pharisees know Mosaic law. They know it. They know what Deuteronomy says. They know what Leviticus says. They know that it says Israel should stone an Israelite who is caught in the act of adultery. But they don't immediately stone this woman, nor the man, and they don't even bring the man into Jesus' presence. Just the woman, which shows hypocrisy. It shows a preference, a superiority in their perception of the genders, right? So John actually tells us they brought the woman to Jesus to test him, to find some way, some breakdown in his teaching so they could accuse him of being a less than teacher than they are. They're using religion to control God. So they ask Jesus, okay, Moses says to stone her, but what do you say? This woman is only a prop to them, an extension to attempt to reclaim some sort of power that they think that they have. And Jesus, in Jesus-like fashion, doesn't answer them, doesn't answer their questions, right? And I always tell you, as Gather is actually going to get started back up, if you ever wonder sometimes why I don't immediately answer your questions live on a Wednesday night, I'm just trying to be like Jesus, right? But I want you to take a look at how Jesus actually responds. Eventually, what he does is that they ask him, he ignores, he stoops down to the ground, and he writes in the dirt of the temple court. Another reason why I think it's probably the court of the Gentiles or the court of women, some of the outer court. And then they persist. Jesus, Moses says this, what do you say? And then in verse 7, he finally begins to answer. And he says this. He says, he who is without sin among you, let him be the first to throw a stone at her. Now, Jesus' response right here cuts really deep into the nature of humanity. Paul, who was a former Pharisee, a former conservative in Judaism, who becomes a Christian, an apostle, a theologian, a church planter, a pastor, in Romans 3, he said that actually all sin and fall short of the glory of God. And in his argument in Romans 3, he uses the Psalms, Torah, Tanakh, to be able to prove his points. There is no one without sin, even moral conservative people, even Pharisees. Therefore, no one has the inherent authority to stone the adulterous woman. No one actually has the inherent authority to provide lasting justice for what anyone has done, inherently, autonomously. You got to have a different concept of justice to get around that, which Christians do. What Jesus is saying here is that the religious and the irreligious, they have one thing in common. They're both sinners. And at the heart of sin is a rebel heart. Now, after this, Jesus stoops down again. He writes something on the ground, and Bible readers have always wondered, what did Jesus write? There's been dramatizations of this in film, right? We have no idea what Jesus wrote. We only know the effect of what Jesus wrote. And it's very interesting to note that John told us that the scribes and Pharisees, after the second time that he wrote, they leave. They leave that portion of the temple. And they leave oldest to youngest, like in order. Very strange. What did Jesus write? We don't know. We can only speculate. That's fun, right? Instead of stoning the adulterous woman, they leave the temple court and leave Jesus alone with the adulterous woman, which is scandalous because rabbis, God-fearing Jewish men, are not alone with women in this culture and society, which is once again proof that this woman's just a prop and they do not really care of the well-being of the person or Jesus. But Jesus is the only sinless one, the only one with the power, if he wanted to condemn the woman for doing sex her way, her idea versus her God's idea, her creator's idea. He's the only one. And I want you to take a look at what Jesus does in response. It's verses 10 and 11. Jesus straightens up and he says, "Woman, where are they? Did no one condemn you?" And she said, "No one, my Lord." Now look at Jesus here. So simple and so deep. He tells her, go, and then he commands her sexuality. From now on, sin no more. Here we see Jesus show compassion to the woman. Jesus says, "I do not condemn you." Now, if Jesus stopped there, that there was no verse 11b, that would be compassion without truth. And all of those who love just loving on the person without telling them the truth would say, victory in Jesus, right? But this wouldn't be love. That would be indifference. Jesus confronts the woman. And he exposes her sin. And he says, go and sin no more. That's the truth component of love. You see, real love tells the loved truth about themselves. To be restored, to overcome a rebel heart, you must experience both Jesus' compassion and Jesus' truth. This woman needs to hear that, yes, she has fallen and she is broken, yet she is loved and accepted at the same time. One doesn't negate the other. One necessitates the other. And what I want you to consider today is that Jesus is actually speaking to two kinds of people that were present then and still present today. In the scribes and the Pharisees, we find people who use religion to make themselves feel good about themselves and about life, about what they're doing, because religious people find God useful. But in the adulterous woman, we find people who may be exposed to religion and they want to flaunt it. If they know religion wants X, Y, and Z, they will do A, B, and C, just to flaunt, so they can feel good about their own way, their own path to life. And once again, both of these kinds of people actually have the same problem. They are rebel-hearted. One uses religion to rebel, and one flaunts religion to rebel. I'm going to do what I want to do. And over the next 3 Sundays, we are going to expand upon this idea even more, because we're going to take a look at 2 parables over 3 weeks. Next Sunday, the parable of the Good Samaritan. And then for 2 Sundays after that, the parable of the lost sons, plural. I believe that there are people here today in Christ's church who need to see that they are one or two of these kinds of rebels. And what I need you to consider today is this, that a life dedicated, walking out of this place today and dedicating yourself to rebelling from God, either by using religion like the Pharisees, keep being here, keep serving, keep giving, keep trying to do the right things to give the appearance, or using religion so you can flaunt it and just do what you want to do, both kinds of lives will leave you ruined and devastated at the end. Oak Branch, and it's been a while since I used a Tolkien illustration. I'm doing it. You know, he's my favorite fiction writer, him and C.S. Lewis. But here it goes. When Tolkien first released the Middle-earth books in the 50s, of course, there's this wave of writers who wrote in, and a lot of them voicing displeasure over Middle-earth. And one unhappy reader wrote into Tolkien, and she had a problem with the point, specifically with the character Sauron. Sauron is the ultimate evil. He's the ultimate bad boy. All power, he has all these dark armies, all these dark powers, dominion, and it's growing and growing. And then at the end of this saga in Middle-earth, he is undone by a little tiny ring that's destroyed. Makes no sense to this reader. Plot made no sense. Here's Sauron, ultimate evil, and he is then ultimately defeated by the erasure of something so small. And she wrote into Tolkien and said, I'm unsatisfied by this. Explain this to me. And back then, writers would actually write their readers back, which was amazing. And Tolkien wrote her back, and we have it in his letters. There's a book called Letters from Tolkien, and you can see a lot of the things he would write personally to people. And he says, the Ring of Sauron is only one of the various mythical ways of treating the placing of one's life or power in some external object, which is thus exposed to capture or destruction with disastrous results to oneself. That's why I love Tolkien right there. It preaches, Middle Earth preaches. I think this captures the essence of life. Not just for Middle Earth, not just for Sauron, not just for those who rebel against Eru in Lord of the Rings, but for Pharisees and scribes, for those if you consider yourself to be religious, for the adulterous woman, for those who flaunt whatever God says on a topic and you do what you want to do. This speaks to you. Sauron tied all of his power, all of his essence, all of his life, and he channeled it into the one ring. And don't think you're any different. And don't think that I'm any different. Independent of God. This is what we do. This is what the adulterous woman did, right? The adulterous woman poured all that she had. She knows what her culture says and what her God says about sex and sexuality. So she ignores that, flaunts it, and does what she wants to do instead. She doesn't have a literal one ring, but men are her one ring. And don't think that the Pharisees and scribes are any different. Their one ring is pouring all their essence, all their desire, all who they are into religion so they can feel powerful and they can feel in charge and control. And make no mistake, you and I do the same thing naturally. That's what curved in on ourselves means. In the end, when you place your life, your hope, who you are, into anyone or into anything that doesn't have the power to sustain it, one day It may not be today. It may not be tomorrow. It may have been 3 years with this person, right? But one day, that person, like Sauron's ring, will melt away and will leave you exposed and show the ruin of your life. So we ask, what's the answer to this? Put your hope in the only one who will never fade, the only one who cannot be destroyed. Put your hope in a light that cannot be darkened. Jesus is the answer both to the Pharisees' rebellion through religion and the adulterous woman's rebellion by doing sex and relationships her way. He's the answer to both. And the good news is, Jesus is the answer to your rebellion today. Now, this year, we are reading a devotional as a church called Go Forward in Love by Dr. Keller. It's actually a great kind of barrage of kind of the hits of his writings during his life and time here on earth. And recently, we read devotionals in January based on my favorite Keller book, Prodigal God, which, when we go through the parable of the lost sons, I'm going to draw from that on Sundays and Wednesdays. So if you enjoyed that, you're going to hear a little bit more from the book. On January 27, Dr. Keller wrote this. I'll narrate it for you. He met a woman who attended his church, Redeemer, in Times Square, New York City. I can imagine having a church, starting a church from scratch in the heart of Times Square, and it growing, the way it exploded, the way it did, in the heart of all of the Americana that New York City has. It was amazing. But this woman comes up to him at Redeemer, and she told him, you know, growing up, she'd only heard that God accepts people if they're good and ethical. Here in the South, you may have heard people say, God helps those who help themselves. You hear that a lot in the South. It's not biblical whatsoever. She had never heard that God accepts a person not on the basis of what they do or have done, but on the basis of sheer grace through what Jesus has done. Now, it sounds like this woman previously attended a church filled with scribes and Pharisees who spoke truth without compassion. She told Dr. Keller the idea that God accepts out of sheer grace through what Jesus has done and not what she deserves is scary. And I read that devotion. I thought, this must be similar to what the adulterous woman is feeling right now. Left alone with Jesus in the temple, she could be minutes or an hour away from sex outside of marriage act. Maybe feeling shame, maybe not. Who knows? But she's caught, and she's alone with the one person who can stone her. Jesus doesn't accept her because he thinks that sex outside of marriage isn't self-destructive. Because sex outside of marriage is self-destructive. It's like you just want to go ahead and touch a propane fire stove. Just go ahead and touch it. We would never do that. But he doesn't take the modern approach of to each his own, or you can't just say anything to that person. We have to show tolerance. He doesn't do that either. This woman is ruining her life by doing sexuality her way versus the way God created sexuality, and God created sexuality for her enjoyment, but she wants to do it her way. Jesus has compassion for her because he will pay the cost for her rebellion, and that's the gospel. Now, Dr. Keller asked the woman, okay, what is so scary about this? And here's what she says, and this is the quote. She says, if I was saved by my good works, then there would be a limit to what God could ask of me or put me through. I would be like a taxpayer with rights. I would have done my duty, and now I deserve a certain quality of life. I think this captures the Pharisee rebel. And maybe some of you over the years have said, I do this, 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 and this. Why am I hurting? I do this for God. I do this for God. Why am I hurting? We are exemplifying in that moment Pharisee-based religion that treats God as Uncle Sam. business transaction. You do this, I do this, we keep each other out of each other's affairs, and we're good to go. God is a business partner in their own enterprise, not their Lord. He bends to them, they don't bend to him. But then she says this, and it continues on. But if it's really true that I am a sinner saved by sheer grace at God's infinite cost, this is the conclusion, then there's nothing he cannot ask of me. And I think this captures the essence of what's going on with the adulterous woman and Jesus right now. And I believe the essence of what goes on between Jesus and all genuine Christians. Christians are saved from themselves as an act of Jesus' sheer grace. And this grace and this saving cost Jesus infinitely. And because he paid it all, there is nothing that Jesus cannot ask of the Christian. You mean suffer again, Lord? If he paid infinite cost, and if you believe that he paid infinite cost, then that conclusion is right. There's nothing he cannot ask of you. More money? More time? More hurt? Yes. Yes. Because is it anything more than what he suffered on the cross? She's right. Paul, the former Pharisee, says that we are bought with a price. Therefore, you glorify God with your body. He also says that I've been crucified with Christ. It's no longer I who gets to live. It's Christ who lives in me. In the life that I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself up for me. Both of those verses have one thing in common. Paul believes that what Jesus did for him was at infinite cost. And because of that, there's nothing Jesus cannot ask of Paul. And how many times was he stoned, beaten, right? Shipwrecked, right? Plotted for assassination. There's nothing Jesus couldn't ask of Paul. This is why Christians find Jesus so beautiful. The answer to the rebellious nature in all of us, scribes, Pharisees, the adulterous woman, and people in this church, myself included, is the same. We must all experience Jesus as light. And that brings us to application right now. So the call today for application is for you and I to set Jesus as light. And this is how we do it. This is hard. You need community for this. And we do this by allowing Jesus to confront us, to confront our motivations, and to confront us with truth, and not just truth, but with compassion as well. And not just with compassion, but with truth as well. So after verse 11, there's a break in time. And when verse 12 picks back up, the woman is gone. And Jesus pursues and finds the Pharisees. He doesn't need to do this. And we see Jesus speak to the Pharisees and offer truth and compassion to them. And I want you to take a look at it. It's verse 12. Jesus spoke to them, the Pharisees, and said this, "I am the light of the world. He who follows me will not walk in the darkness, but will have the light of life." Now, Jesus wants the Pharisees, yes, the Pharisees, religious people, to see him as light of the world. Now, what does it mean when Jesus says, "I am the light of the world"? It's a metaphor, so we got to go into the metaphor and then peel back. Jesus compares himself to the literal light of our world, which is the sun. Earth and all the planets in our system revolve around one thing, and it's not you, it's not Jupiter, as grand as Jupiter is, it's the sun. The sun is the source and the ability for why we have life here on this earth, and not Mercury or Venus. We're not Mars. We're not way out there in the galaxy. It had to be right here and right here alone. Can you imagine the earth personified speaking to the sun? "Hey, sun, I no longer want to orbit you anymore. I've done it for too long. I want to create my own orbit. I want to follow my own path. Or how about this, son? You follow me around. What would happen if the earth had the ability to say and do that? Earth takes one step closer to the sun, burn up, right? Earth takes one step away from the sun, we freeze up, right? And that is why creation honors and worships God better than we will ever. They do it naturally. Life on earth is dependent on earth following sun, orbiting itself around the sun, in trajectory relationship to the sun. And Jesus says, I'm the light of the world. As it goes with the world, so it goes with you. This is the irony. We are all in the dark, independently, on our own, about ourselves, about people, and about life. Due to our rebellious nature, we think by flaunting that we are carving out our own lives, our own satisfaction, doing things our way versus how it should be, doing what we want, when we want it, how we want it, with little or no regard for God, and no one can tell me otherwise. But all that we are doing is killing ourselves. I say this to you often, and it's been a while, but I've said something like this to you over the years, especially since my mom passed away. Science cannot explain why you die. Science can only explain how you die. To answer the question of why you die and why your loved ones die, you need philosophy and you need religion. Science can't do that. What gets printed on a medical examiner's death certificate explains how the person died, what variables and factors caused the life to end. Science can never answer why questions. And that's why atheist scientists, they're just replacing religion with a new religion for themselves. Only philosophy and religion can do this. And this is what makes Jesus so special. Jesus provides the best answer and the resolution to sin and suffering and injustice and death. Jesus takes it on because only someone more powerful than sin and injustice and suffering and Satan and evil and death can destroy it. So here Jesus is offering truth and compassion to the Pharisees and to you. He calls on them and he calls on you to follow him. So we have to ask, what does it mean to follow Jesus? Following Jesus looks like your life orbiting him and not Jesus orbiting you. Like he is some satellite to make your earth better. That's what following Jesus means. Religious people find Jesus useful. They put Jesus and religion into their orbit. That's what the Pharisees did. And that's what many churchgoers do today. Okay, it's practical. Make spouse happy. Maybe gets me out of the house. Right? Happy wife, happy life. I'll do it. And all you're doing is making Jesus your satellite. That's all you're doing. You're just being a Pharisee. Following Jesus means discovering and then doing what Jesus says about life. It's about putting our lives into his orbit. Jesus says, walk with me and you will not walk in darkness. Walking all throughout the Bible. Walking is a really big expression, especially in the Psalms in the Old Testament. It's a simple expression of a personal relationship. I love to walk with Tisa. Love to do it. It gets me out of the house. It gets me away from technology. We get to lock into step, like literally, taking the same steps together, shoulder to shoulder, which is big for me. We talk about life. She has an opportunity to voice whatever I need to fix. We move forward together. What's Jesus saying? Walk with me. I want to have a personal relationship with you. Follow me. Put me It's the center of your orbit. Real life begins when you walk with Jesus, when you get into his orbit and follow his pattern. And Jesus attaches a promise to this. If you follow Jesus as your light, you will have life. Jesus will be your light in the darkness. Jesus will be your life in your death. The application today is to allow Jesus to confront motivations. So how do people become confronted with their rebellion today? Because Jesus isn't searching through Jerusalem's temple looking for the Pharisees right now. The temple's destroyed. That kind of Judaism has been dead. It's rabbinic Judaism now for a couple thousand years. So how does Jesus do this? You know what he does? He uses his word. He uses the scriptures. And he uses the Holy Spirit as the tools of that confrontation. And he uses it still for people, still for rebels, those who are using religion and those who are flaunting religion to make themselves feel good and satisfied and entertained and to get through the day. To be a Christian means that Jesus has spoken deeply into that nature with truth and compassion. And for this nature to change, truth must be spoken. And Jesus speaks the truth. You are broken and sinful beyond what you can imagine. And Jesus shows compassion. Despite this, you are loved and accepted beyond what you could ever dare hope. So as a church, we must be committed to not be like the Pharisees, but then also to not be like the adulterous woman. We must make a commitment to experience Jesus' compassion and truth, and then to show those two things to other people as well. So I want to close with a quote from the great London Baptist preacher, Charles Spurgeon. Because I want to help you see the relationship between preaching and teaching, what a church does, the pastoral ministry of a church, and how it supports the ministry of Jesus as light of the world. Charles Spurgeon is probably in the top 10 greatest preachers of all Christendom, but he is certainly by far the best Baptist preacher. Certainly. Here's what he says. He says, our ministry ought always to be a killing as well as a healing one. A ministry that kills all false hopes, blights all wrong confidences, and weeds out all foolish trusts, while at the same time trains up the feeblest shoots of real hope and tends comfort and encouragement even to the weakest of sincere followers of Christ. Do not then be needlessly alarmed about our ministry. Just give us plenty of elbow room to strike to the right and to strike to the left. To our own master, we stand or fall, but to no one else in heaven or on earth. What an amazing writer right there. Preaching and teaching scripture kills and it heals. Jesus killed the false hope, both of the Pharisees and the adulterous woman, and what they were trusting in. Jesus uses preaching and teaching of a church to help people to experience him as light into their darkness, to see that life is best spent orbiting him and not the other way around. So on the one end, preaching and teaching kills. It hurts, right? It is a sword that pierces to the heart. It kills our false hopes in this life. It devastates the things and it calls out the things that we put our confidence in that cannot provide lasting eternal comfort. It weeds out all the things that we're trusting in over Jesus. Yet at the same time, it heals. It provides real hope, comfort, and encouragement, especially to those who consider themselves to be the weakest of Christians. So as a Christian at Branchton, you must continually find Jesus as light and life by saying, okay, Lord, Wednesdays are coming, Sundays are coming, come and do it again. Come and do it again. If you need to hurt, hurt. If you need to heal, heal. If you need to pull out some weeds, pull out some weeds. You do this by allowing God's word to hurt and to heal you time and time again until, like Jesus, you offer both truth and compassion to all kinds of people. If you are the person that's like all truth, no compassion, people in your life start discovering, whoa, you are a lot more sweeter than what you used to be. On the other hand, if you were all compassion and no truth, like, my goodness, you have told me some things that you have never told me about myself in the past, and thank you. That's when you know you are enjoying Jesus as light of the world.